Well, thank you, Sarju, for inviting me today to join you. And if I can just start by saying how great it is to see so many young people here. I started my army career as a young cub, and then a scout, and then a cadet. So I love being with youngsters and seeing them starting off on their careers, and I wish them all the very best of luck. And I do want to thank very much the instructors and the adults who look after them, because you do a fantastic job, and I don't think we always appreciate that in as much as we should. All over the world, millions of men, women, and children will gather together today for a service of remembrance. Some will do so in the great cathedrals, others in cities and towns like us today, and villages around their cenotaphs and their war memorials and in their churches. Over the years, as you can imagine, I've taken part in many such services, from the warmth and sunshine in Nicosia in Cyprus to the bitter November winds of West Germany. And I suspect, like many of you, I've visited many of the battlefields and the war cemeteries in Europe and the Middle East, from Verdun to El Alamein, from Dunkirk to Flanders, and most recently from Basra to Baghdad. France and Belgium are good countries in which to contemplate war. There are other places equally appropriate, like Belsen or Auschwitz, Stalingrad or Hiroshima. But France and Belgium were the killing fields of the British Army in the First World War and the scenes of some of the most desperate and determined fighting in the Second. Our commemorations can, if we're not careful, take on a rather dispassionate, cool approach. But the essential fact of war, what needs to be remembered above all else, is death, merciless and brutal, spreading across Europe and the world. War is not speeches or parades, it is pain and suffering and death in Flanders and Dunkirk, Normandy and the Somme, Burma and the Western Desert, and all of the many other battlefields around the world, from places like Korea and Malaysia and places in Africa and, of course, more recently, Iraq and Afghanistan. The War Graves Commission maintains 27,000 war graves all around the world, sites of war graves around the world. And in them are buried 1.7 million Commonwealth war dead. The occasional half an hour over the years in a quiet military cemetery in France has done more to bring home the reality of all of this than anything else, more so even than my experiences in those places we spoke of earlier. There are 3,222 British cemeteries in France from the two world wars, and 712 in Belgium. Between them, 779,684 British and Commonwealth soldiers are buried and commemorated. 574,870 in France, 204,814 in Belgium. This year is the 103rd anniversary of the Battle of the Somme, which started on the 1st of July 1916 and ended about now, 4.5 months later, on November the 13th. Stretching in a line from the northern end of the battlefield at Gamincourt to Mametz, 12 miles south, there is a war cemetery every quarter of a mile. 5,000 are buried at Devil Wood, 4,000 at Highwood, and more than 1,500, including three pairs of brothers, at Flatiron Copse in Death Valley under Mametz Wood. Just a few of the 419,654 British and Commonwealth casualties suffered in 4.5 months. Around 220,000 of the dead in France and 102,000 in Belgium, more than half the dead of Ypres and Passchendaele, have never been identified. Over 160,000 bodies have never been recovered. 10 or 20 are found every year, even today, when farmers plough their fields or builders dig foundations or excavate ditches on the battlefields. They are heart-rending places, these cemeteries. The white tombstones stand in long, straight rows, with their shadows marching in rank behind them. They're beautifully kept by the War Graves Commission, the stones planted in flower beds, the grass mowed close. On each, where known, is the name, rank, and age of the soldier, sailor, or airman buried there, with their regimental badge. And often some words are etched into the stone. The numbers are awesome. But each headstone and name represents a husband or a son, a father or a brother. On the headstone of a young Gordon Highlander in the cemetery of El Alamein, I found these words: "Will we be worthy of the things for which he died?" On another headstone, that of a 23-year-old private in the Leicestershire Regiment, buried in the military cemetery near Changi in Singapore, I found these words from his loving mother: "Sleep on, dear son, in a far-off land, in a grave I will never see." And on another, in Bayeux, surrounded by tens of thousands of headstones, I found these words from the parents of a young 19-year-old private soldier: "To the world, he was but one of many. But to us, he was all the world." That's the reality of the awesome statistics. For each headstone represents a personal tragedy, and some, however, tell a story between them that is almost too much to bear. Major Joe Thorne of the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry is buried in Cassel, a small hill town 18 miles south of Dunkirk. His regiment were part of the rear guard protecting the beaches, effectively destroyed on the 29th of May 1940. 6 days before the last boats left. Joe's two older brothers were killed in an earlier war on the Somme, and two of his cousins were killed near Béthune in 1915. A whole generation wiped out. The patriarch of the family, their grandfather, was a namesake of mine, the Reverend Marlborough Cross, the vicar of a rural parish in Norfolk. It's difficult to imagine what he must have gone through holding the memorial services for each of his five grandsons, one after the other. Second Lieutenant Ewan Cross of the Leicestershire Regiment, Joe Thorne's cousin, is listed on the war memorial at Le Touré near Béthune, along with 13,481 other men whose bodies were never identified. He was killed on the 16th of May, 1915, in a battle of absolutely no military significance known as the Battle of Festubert. He was 19 years old. In this church with us today are many soldiers of that age. His elder brother, Lieutenant Marlborough Cross, named after his grandfather, was killed 2 months earlier at Neuf-Chapelle. He was 21. He's buried in a somber cemetery at a place the British called Windy Corner, near the Eyre Canal. I've seen a photograph of him, taken just before the war. A rather serious-looking boy in a suit and waistcoat on his way up to Cambridge. On the back, his mother had written his name, the regiment, and an epitaph: "Our hero boy, who died in early years, in men's regret, in women's tears." The history of the East Surrey Regiment records that on the night of the 27th of September 1915, Second Lieutenant Marlborough Thorne, known as Mally, Joe's brother, and also named like his cousin after his grandfather, went out on a patrol with a private Warby with the intention of bombing a German sniper and to see if certain craters were held in no man's land. Soon after they left, Warby returned and reported that Mally had been shot. A Lance Sergeant Conquest then led three patrols out to try to bring him in. In the third, they got well out in spite of heavy machine gun fire, but they failed to find the missing officer. Lieutenant Cornelius Thorne, Mally's brother, then went out with a Private Hind to try to find him, and he did so, and Cornelius brought him in on his back. But Mally was found to be dead. Cornelius won an MC, Private Hine a medal for distinguished conduct in the field. Mally is buried in a shallow valley near Albert. The lines of the trenches can still be clearly seen along the crest of the ridges. Cornelius Thorne, who brought him in from no man's land, was killed exactly a year later in one of the last actions of the Battle of the Somme, an assault on the German positions at Thiepval Ridge near Albert. The largest of all the British war memorials stands there now, 150 foot high, 16 immense pillars supporting an arch lined with marble, on which are inscribed the 73,000 421 men killed in the Battle of the Somme, whose bodies have never been found. This is the battle in which 19,240 British soldiers died out of 57,470 casualties suffered in one day, most of them by the middle of the day, 1st of July 1916. It's a battle in which the furthest British advance totaled just 12 kilometres. And amongst those listed on the memorial is Cornelius Thorne. Another enormous memorial to the British dead is the Menin Gate at Ypres, commemorating 55,000 men who have no known grave. Some of the panels have been replaced recently because the names have become unreadable from the wind, the rain, and the pollution. Her Majesty the Queen was there back in 1998 on the 11th of November with between 15 and 20 survivors of the mud and the destruction. Today, of course, there are none left to tell their stories. Yet today and every day at 8 p.m. in the evening, a unit of the Belgian Army will parade at the Menin Gate, stop the traffic that runs through the arch and sound the last post. That ceremony began in 1928, and it was interrupted in 1940 when the Germans, in a two-week offensive, overran northern France, achieving in a few months what 4 years and a million dead had failed to win in the First World War. 4 years later, on the very day that the Germans evacuated Ypres, a Belgian veteran emerged from the rubble, returned to the gate and sounded last post. He remembered, and so must we. The war, of course, did not stop in 1918. The years since have been just as awful, in some respects more so. Nearly 10 million died, 765,000 of the British in the World War I. Yet within 21 years, many of that same generation found themselves embroiled in another, even greater war. And this time, 55 million died. And until recently, there had only been 1 year since 1945 when a British serviceman had not been killed on operations around the world. We have, of course, seen our soldiers deployed, as I said earlier, in places like Korea and Malaya and Cyprus and elsewhere, and more recently Afghanistan and Iraq, where many hundreds have died and been wounded in action, many very badly. I remember visiting one of my young officers lying in a Birmingham hospital with one arm and one leg blown off and the second in danger of being amputated, having been hit with an IED. So what then does Remembrance Sunday amount to amongst such suffering, amongst the continuing carnage of war, amongst such catalogues of human misery? Why bother, we may ask, to remember when we know that there will be other wars, further genocides? Not surprisingly, I think it amounts to something very important. The most common form of remembrance follows personal loss, and for many today, this and every Remembrance Sunday is a very personal day. But collectively, we undertake an act of remembrance for those to whom we're not related, we don't know them personally, but who have lost their lives in some general cause or great disaster. We're all touched in some way or other by remembering the dead of the great wars, the victims of the Holocaust, or the terrible events of September the 11th. For the survivors and the relatives of those who have died, the memory is more acute, more personal, more searing. But the magnitude of what has happened produces, or should produce, a collective, not just individual, sense of loss and suffering. But whilst this is certainly one important reason why we should remember, on its own, I don't think it's enough. In the Hebrew tongue, to remember means more than just recounting such events and facts, tragic and important as they are. Remember the old Beatles song, "Yesterday don't matter if it's gone." That tends to be our approach. We tend to try to put the past behind us. But the Bible acknowledges that yesterday is important, and it couples remembering first with thanksgiving, which Sarju mentioned earlier, constantly underlying that a true man of faith not only remembers, but returns to give thanks, whilst unbelievers have short and ungrateful memories. And that applies to nations as well as individuals. And remembering carries with it the intention of learning from the past, bringing the lessons into the present and carrying them with us into the future. That intent is twofold. First, to help produce a better future, a collective resolve to do better, a determination to ensure that the evil that is past will not recur easily. Secondly, to give us individual resolve as we face up to the future crises and conflicts in our own lives, which we know will occur. Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi, once said that those who carry the heritage of the past can face the future without fear. Doesn't mean there'll be no pain or suffering, only that we can bear it better, maybe love better. A Polish Jew was once asked how he'd gained the courage and the strength to survive the horrors of the concentration camps. He replied that whilst character is the sum of many things, much of it stems from all that we do and learn in our early years. He explained that Jewish history is full of tragedy, but also of examples of individual and collective courage. As a child and a young student, he'd learned all about that history, and he had resolved, if a testing time should ever come to him, he would do his utmost to stand firm. He'd learnt the lessons of the past. He carried them with him through his life, and when his testing time came, he did indeed stand firm. And the traditions and the regimental histories of the British Army have always tried to provide the same kind of resolve. And all young officers and soldiers quickly become rooted in their regiments and battalions past in order to help them maintain and uphold their honour in the future. Now, there are many, of course, many lessons we can learn from the events we remember today, and I want to offer just two. First, we must not take the freedom and democracy we enjoy today for granted. The Berlin Wall may have come down 30 years ago, but sadly the heart of man has not and will not change. My recent experiences dealing with those refugees, the tens of thousands of refugees forced out of Kosovo by Milosevic and his cronies, the ravages of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, are just recent examples of that. Since the start of recorded history, there have been around 270 years of worldwide peace. 270 out of about 3,500. Can we really believe, indeed have we any right to believe, that that is going to change? The Bible certainly does not promise that this world will somehow evolve into a better place. Indeed, the reverse is true. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed, for these must happen. Not until the return of the Lord himself will we see war finally overcome. Why? Because we live in a fallen world with one central and major problem. You may remember the famous letter sent to the Times during the debate on what was wrong with the world. And I think it was G.K. Chesterton who wrote in the simple reply, "You ask what is wrong with the world? I am." As Paul reminds us in his letter to the church in Rome, and as Sarju said earlier on today, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We are part of the problem. Secondly, peace is not about an absence of war. As a soldier for over 40 years, I faced the reality of war breaking out around me and experienced its effects, the bitterness of religious bigotry and division in Northern Ireland, ethnic division and hatred in Cyprus and across the Balkans, and oppression and barbarism in Iraq twice in 12 years. I've seen pretty awful things in those conflicts and have experienced the pain of loss. But two, throughout this time, I've come to understand that peace is not about an absence of war, nor is it about a pain or crisis-free life. Jesus Christ said many things about peace, but not once did he associate it with the world as a whole, but rather with an individual and inner spiritual peace. I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have trouble, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. In this nuclear age, we would do well to remember what General Bradley, the US commander in France, in 1944-45 said. Humanity is in danger of being trapped in this world by its moral adolescence. Our knowledge of science has clearly outstripped our capacity to control it. Man is stumbling through a spiritual darkness whilst toying with the secrets of life and death. We have too many men of science, too few men of God. We have grasped the mystery of the atom and rejected the Sermon on the Mount. The world has achieved brilliance without wisdom, power without conscience. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants. Now, I have no time for pious hopes, but as a soldier, I have seen and learnt enough of both peace and war over the last 30 years to know that he was right then and he is right now. Jesus Christ's peace is a peace that the world cannot give. Indeed, it does not largely understand it, and Remembrance Sunday should serve as a reminder for that too. Finally, Remembrance Sunday is, of course, epitomized by the poppy. At the Second Battle of Ypres in 1915, when in charge of a small first aid post and during a short lull in the battle, a Canadian colonel called John McCrae, in peacetime a well-known professor of medicine at the great Canadian University of McGill, wrote in a pencil on a page torn from his dispatch book these words: "In Flanders fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amidst the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with those who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields." In January 1918, Colonel John McCrae was brought as a stretcher case himself to one of the big hospitals on the Channel coast of France. And on the third evening there, he was wheeled out onto the balcony of his room to look over the sea to England. The verses were obviously on his mind, because he told the doctors, "Tell them this, if they break faith with those of us who die, we shall not sleep." And that same night, Colonel McCrae died. He's buried in a beautiful cemetery on rising ground above Vimereux, from where the cliffs of Dover are easily visible on sunny days. The verses he wrote were sent anonymously to Punch magazine and published under the title Flanders Fields. And of course, that's from where our poppies that we proudly wear come from. It's, of course, easy on a day like today to become somewhat over-sentimental, but the fact remains that those who died, like John McCrae, the Thorns, and that 19-year-old private who lies at Bayeux, were no different to us. They had the same hopes and the fears that we do. They enjoyed life, they had plans for the future, yet when the call came, they were prepared to die to save Europe and the world from oppression and dictatorship. When you go home, tell of us and say, "For your tomorrow, we gave our today." To give one's life is as much as there is to give. It is the ultimate sacrifice. As Jesus Christ himself said, "Greater love has no man than this, that he should lay down his life for his friends." And he should know. When we talk about sacrifice, we need to see it in the perspective of a hill outside Jerusalem where God gave his only son for you and for me and for the world, the great reconciliation. In Dusseldorf in Germany, there used to be a famous painting of the crucifixion on the wall of the cathedral. And as you looked up into the eyes of Christ, the words at the base of the painting asked, "All this I have done for thee. What hast thou done for me?" It's a good question. I wonder what your answer is. So it is with the Flanders poppy as our symbol. We remember and we return to give thanks for all those who gave their lives for our freedom and for those who suffer still. We pray too for peace and for reconciliation. But if we are wise, we also learn and remember some lessons of the past and carry them with us into our uncertain futures as we leave this church today. For although we may not know what the future holds, we can at least know and trust in him who holds the future. And when our time comes, we too can say, like the words of the tombstone of a young soldier in a British war cemetery in the northern part of Baghdad, "My duty done, labor ended, Jordan passed." Amen.